This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalrymple Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
I'm interviewing Dr. Alvaro Sanchez Monge, who's just done a colloquium here at JBCA for us. So welcome.
Nice to be here.
And you're working, if my pronunciation is not too bad, at the Osservatorio Astrofisico di Arcetri.
Yeah,
is that right, in
perfectly.
Italy?
It's a place in Italy. It's involved in the INAF, in the Instituto Nazionale di Astrofisica, the National Institute of Astrophysics. And this observatory, Astrophysical Observatory in Arcetri, is located in Florence, in a beautiful city. You must go there to visit it. And it's interesting that the observatory is located at only 400 meters of distance with respect to the House of Galileo. So
really,
we have the keys of the House of Galileo. We can enter it and see the place where he was sleeping. It's a nice place.
And presumably the observatory, though, wasn't there when he was
doing his studies. In fact, the main observatory at that epoch was in the center of the city because the city was much smaller. Mm-hmm. So he was living away of the central part of the city, but now the city has been growing and the observatory has been displaced a bit from the center of the city, and now it's located close to the House of Galileo.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure he would have enjoyed using the observatory's facilities.
Yeah, sure.
So what you work on is actually then star formation. That's what you were telling us about today, and particularly high mass star formation.
Yeah, it works during my PhD and now during my postdoc. I'm currently a postdoc in Arcetri. I work on star formation, but mainly on the formation of high mass stars. And high mass stars are those stars that have masses 6, 8, 10 or more times more massive or greater, higher than the mass of our sun. So they are really huge stars. So we are studying them because it's not clear how the formation of these stars occurs.
Okay. Well, I was learning a lot from this because I normally study stars which are dead.
So the opposite.
This is going back to how they're born. So when we talk about low mass stars, as you started off, how do we understand their formation? You were talking about the different stages of evolution that they go through.
Yeah, in simple words, what we can think that the star forms from a large molecular cloud, so it's like a cloud like those that we see in the sky, but it's not in the sky, but in the interstellar medium, in the universe, in the space, and it's really huge. It contains dust, particles of dust, like the dust that we can see in our houses, but bit larger, and simple molecules. Some of them are hydrogen, molecular hydrogen, CO, so monoxide carbon, ammonia. So there are some simple molecules in this gas. And this cloud, due to some mechanisms, probably the explosion of a supernova or some interaction, this gas becomes altered, affected, and then it starts to compress, to contract, to collapse, and then in the center of this cloud that is collapsing appears a small core condensation that it's really dense and really hot, and then it will become a star. So we start with a large cloud that collapses, contracts, until we have a small condensation that will be a star. And surrounding this star during all this process, it's interesting that this material of the cloud, as it falls to the center, to the protostar, what happens is that it is concentrated on a plane surrounding the star. And in this plane, what we obtain is a disk. And from this disk, what we obtain is the planets, the formation of planets. So we can understanding the formation of stars, we can also understand the formation of the planets and comets and asteroids.
So when you were first talking about the low-mass stars, you talked about the spectrum, so the amount of energy that we're receiving at different wavelengths.
Yeah.
And then what was it about the high-mass stars that sort of defied the classification applied to low-mass stars?
Yeah, regarding low-mass stars, what happens is that they form so slowly that you can make a picture of each evolutionary stage in the formation of this low mass star without any problem, because they evolve really slow. But for high mass star, this is the opposite. They form really fast. So if what happens in low mass stars is that you can take a picture when the cloud is huge, so you will see the cloud. Then you can take a picture when the cloud is more compact and it's forming a dense core, and then you will see this dense core. Then you can take a picture when this dense core is associated with a disk. So the protostar is associated with a disk, and then you see the emission of the star and the disk. And then in the end, you can see the emission of the disk and the planets around the star. For high mass stars, what happens is that the star form so quickly that when you have the cloud that is collapsing, contracting to the center, in the center, you have already formed a star, but in the surroundings, you still have enough material to continue the creation. So you have the star with the disk and the star with the planets, while this is still embedded in the large cloud. So if you are taking pictures, you are always seeing the cloud. So you cannot see the details. You have to use different techniques, not only the spectral density distribution that traces these different emission, but in this case, only the cloud. So you have to use interferometers, other telescopes to go inside and see the details of the stars that are forming within the cloud.
Okay. That was going to bring me on to the next question, actually, which was how you make observations of these star-forming regions. Is it mostly infrared?
Yeah, we cannot use optical telescopes, so the more common telescopes like any people can have in their houses, because the emission of the stars that are forming within the cloud is highly obscured, absorbed by the dust, and then we cannot go inside the dust and see the details of what is happening there. So we need to use infrared observations, infrared telescopes, but not only infrared, but we have to move more to the red part of the spectrum, so to the radio wavelength. So we are observing in millimeter and centimeter wavelength. So the same frequencies that you use in your radio or in your TV are the same frequencies that we are using to observe inside these clouds to see what's happening and how stars are forming.
Okay. So then you were talking about observing different kinds of molecules, so different materials that are inside these disks. How do you know when you're looking at this molecule or that molecule, and what does it tell you about the star that's forming?
Yeah, if we think in the emission that we can see with our eyes, this is mainly continuum emission. So it's all the emission at different frequencies that is processed all together and forms the white light or yellow light or these things. But if we can use a spectrograph or a prism, we can separate the emission, this white light that we are seeing in different frequencies. This is the same like the rainbow. Mm-hmm. So we can see that the white light is in fact a combination of red, yellow, green, blue. And if we can even separate more this emission, we will see that all the yellow light is not yellow, but is yellow, but we have at some specific frequencies an increase in the emission. And these frequencies are associated with the presence of molecules or of atoms or ions in the source that is producing the light. So by knowing at which frequency we are seeing this increase of the emission, we can determine which molecule is, and then we can say, okay, this frequency is associated with ammonia or with hydrogen or with SiO, with different molecules. And then each molecule can be used to trace different parts in the formation of a star, in the gas that it's forming a star. Because while simple molecules such as hydrogen or ammonia, or a bit more complicated N2H+, that it's two nitrogens and an ionized hydrogen atom together. So these molecules are emitting emission when they are associated or they are lying in the dense gas. So by observing this species, what we see is the dense gas. if we use other molecules such as SiO or other a bit more complex HCO plus, what we see is the outflow and the, so emission that is not tracing the large cloud or the dense condensation, but emission that has been ejected at high velocities from the star. Because during the process of formation of a star, we not only have a disk, but also ejection of matter perpendicular to this disk. So the process of formation is a bit more complex than what I explained before. But these molecules tracing the outflows, we know that they trace outflows because they can only be produced in the chocks. So this ejection of matter chocks with the dust grains that are in the cloud, and this chalk permits the production of these other molecules. And then if we see this molecule, we are pretty sure that they are associated with ejection of matter and outflow. And then by studying different molecules, we can trace different parts of what is happening inside the molecular cloud.
Okay, so it's like a different way of making the picture, I suppose, rather than just saying, well, it's over here or it's over here. You're using those different materials to unpick the different parts of the cloud.
Yeah, it's like if you are taking a picture of, for example, of a rainbow, and then you put a filter in your camera with only a yellow filter, and then you will only pick the yellow part of the rainbow. And if you pick, you put a blue filter, you will only see the blue part of the rainbow. And then you can combine all these different pictures that you have to understand what's happening, that in this case is the presence of a rainbow or formation of a star.
Okay. So now we're sort of building up this picture. You've got the disk, and then these jets or outflows are coming from two parts. Are they going sort of
during
up and down?
The point is that due to the collapse, and this large cloud can be rotating. So it has a movement, so it rotates. And if you contract all this emission, the rotation in the gas that is more compact is higher than the rotation seen at large scales. And this is due to the conservation of angular momentum. It's like in an ice skater that it can start to turn. And if he opens the arms, he will rotate slowly. And if he put the arms close to the body, then it starts to rotate faster. So it's the same effect. So the conservation of angular momentum. And during this process of accretion and conservation of angular momentum, what happens is that if all the material try to reach the central part of the condensation of the star, you can make some numbers, and what happens is the angular momentum, the rotation velocity is too high, and then the material does not fall to the center, but is ejected to another part. So in the end, there would be a problem if only accretion was involved in the formation of a star. And the solution is that this ejection of material permits to eject part of this angular momentum, allowing the material to continuously be accrete and collapse onto the central part and form the condensation. And this ejection of material, these outflows, are typically found to be perpendicular to the disk of the to the plane of the disk.
Okay, so that's sort of a giveaway of a star formation.
Yeah.
Which is another thing I was going to ask, which is how then, when you're just looking around the sky or doing a survey, how do you identify what is a star-forming region or some star-forming?
Nice question. We can think about the first surveys that were done historically to identify these regions, and they were majorly done in infrared wavelengths. So they observed at far infrared wavelengths at 100 microns. They did an observation of the full sky. There is a satellite called IRAS that made this work. And this satellite found a number of strong sources in the infrared. And if this source is only detected in the infrared, and you use another telescope in the optical, and you point to the same place in the sky and you see nothing, it means that the emission associated with this object is really cold. So the temperature may be as low as 10 Kelvin, so minus 260 Celsius degrees, so it's really cold. And the clouds that are forming stars are in fact dense structures and cold structures with temperatures of 10, 20, 30 kelvins. So if you know that there is a source emitting strongly in the far infrared, but not in the optical, you can say, okay, this seems that it could be forming a star. So let's check with other tracers and see what is happening there. And then the next step is to use, for example, some lines, the observations of some molecules. And one of the most used is the CO, so one carbon and one oxygen. And if you point toward this infrared source and you see that there is a large amount of CO emission, of molecular emission, you can say, okay, it's cold and it's associated with molecular gas. So it seems that there could be a molecular cloud there, and then probably something is happening. Then you can start to observe it at different wavelengths in the millimeter or infrared, as I said before, or other molecules. And then you start to find details in this large structure of infrared emission or CO emission. And then you can be sure that if there is star formation ongoing or not.
Okay. It's like a detective.
Yeah. There.
So when you've been doing these observations fairly recently and choosing a certain sample of these sorts of sources, what kind of things or features have you found in the high mass star forming regions?
Yeah. If you are interested in searching for massive star forming regions instead of low mass star forming regions, you have to take into account different aspects. And one of them is that the mass that you can derive from the, for example, the CO molecule for the cloud that you are observing is a huge mass. So if you find an object and it has only 10 solar masses, probably it will fragment, and in the end it will only form stars of 1-2 solar masses, so low mass stars. But if you observe this object and you see that the mass is 1,000, 10,000 solar masses, then you can say, okay, it seems that at some point it, or maybe now it's forming stars, so it will form stars. Other things that you can check is the presence of H2 regions, for example. And these H2 regions are produced when you have a star that is already formed, so a star like our sun, but more massive. This star produces a large number of ultraviolet photons, so photons, high energy radiation, and these photons interact with the material of the cloud. And when they find or interact with a molecular hydrogen, for example, what they make is to split this molecule of two hydrogens in two separated atoms of hydrogen. And then another photon can achieve this atom of hydrogen and can ionize. So you separate the central proton of the hydrogen and the electron. So in the end, what you have is like a cloud of ions, of ionized material. And this is the H2 region, a region of ionized hydrogen. And these regions are only associated, if they are associated with young objects, are only found if the star is massive enough, because a star like our sun does not produce enough ultraviolet photons to ionize the medium. So if you know that there is an H2 region, you can say 100% sure that it's forming massive star. There are other signposts of massive star formation, like hot cores and several things.
Well, yeah, I guess the interesting thing is how the details are telling us about what's happening. So I know you have these very, very dense cores that you're looking at, and also you were talking about having some excess of the radio emission that you were seeing, something that was more than expected.
Yeah, this is a final result that we have found. And regarding these H2 regions that we were talking about, if you know the type of the star that is producing the H2 region, you can calculate easily the number of atoms of hydrogen that can be ionized. So you can say, okay, if I have a star that is 20 times more massive than our sun, this star will be able to ionize 1,000 atoms. If I have a more massive star, this star will be able to ionize certain number of atoms. And then you can compute the maximum number of atoms that you can ionize for each, for every luminosity of the star that it's being formed. And what we found is that if we compute the number of atoms that are ionized for a certain luminosity, for a large number of objects, this number of atoms were well above the maximum limit. So it's strange because how can a star ionize more atoms than what it should ionize? So what's happening here? And it's not clear. We thought that maybe there were some problems with our observations, but we checked them and it seems it's okay. And in fact, there are other groups that are starting to find the same results. So it seems that it's a thing, a sure thing, something is happening there. And probably it's related with the theory that we are using now. So this maximum limit of photons that we are computing probably is not well computed. So maybe we have to improve our knowledge, our models, and see if this maximum limit can be affected by other effects such as the accretion that proceeds or other effects associated with the formation of stars. And then if we are, we can investigate this and we can then find the solution of this excess of radio emission that we were finding.
And did you say it could be something to do with the narrow angle or wide angle of the outflow jets?
Yeah, instead modifying the models, we can think another alternative that is the so-called flashlight effect. And what it means is that if you have a region that is not homogeneous, so you have some holes in this cloud that is forming the star, part of the radiation that is produced by the already formed star can escape through these holes and we cannot detect them. So probably we are saying, okay, we have a star of 1,000 solar luminosity, so 1,000 times more luminous than our sun. It should produce 10 to the 40 photons per second, so it should be able to ionize 10 to the 40 atoms of hydrogen. But what we are seeing is that it ionizes 10 to the 45, so 5 orders of magnitude more than expected. Maybe what is happening is that the luminosity of this source is not 1,000 solar luminosity as we are measuring, but it's more. It's 3,000 solar luminosities. Then a star of 3,000 solar luminosities may ionize 10 to the 45 and then everything is fine. And the problem is this flashlight effect says that, okay, take into account that if you have cavities in your envelope, part of the radiation may escape and then the 1,000 luminosity is just a lower limit. And then if you take into account this radiation that has been escaped through the holes, the real luminosity is 3,000 solar luminosities and then everything is clear. Mm-hmm. But it's also strange that because in our sample, almost 50% of the sources were above this maximum limit. So it's strange that 50% of the sources have this effect of the flashlight effect. No, it's a large number. It's interesting. But it's another thing to be taken into account. So changing the models or this flashlight effect, or maybe there is another solution. Let's see what's happened.
Wow. Well, just to finish off then, I suppose that leads on to the observations that will happen in the future. You were talking about already using ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. But of course, that's not actually finished being constructed yet, even though it's already working. So how are you going to be using that telescope?
Yeah, the power of ALMA, of the largest observatory in the world, is that we will be able to observe tiny details in the formation of stars with a high sensitivity. So, for example, now with the eMERLIN, for example, the array that is located here in the UK, we can obtain tiny details of everything. The problem is that the sensitivity is not high enough. So if you want to search for a disk, for example, detect how the disk is formed around the star and how the planets are forming inside this disk, and you use eMERLIN, what happens is that the emission is so faint that maybe you can observe the spatial scale of a planet, but you will not detect them because your noise is high above the noise that you should have. And ALMA will permit to achieve the tiny details, the resolutions that, for example, eMerlin achieves, but with the improvement of in sensitivity, because we have more than 60 telescopes, while in eMerlin there are only 6 or 7 telescopes, so 10 times more. And thanks to these tiny details, so this high resolution and the high sensitivity, we will be able to search for this disk or the planets that are forming around the stars. And so when ALMA would be at 100% of its capabilities, probably in a few months, astronomy is going to be a fascinating science, I think.
So you're going to be able to look into these smaller regions than ever before and see directly what's happening in some way.
It's searching for low mass stars. It's not high mass stars, but for low mass stars, you will be able to resolve especially the disk around the star. So you probably start to see some gaps, and these gaps indicate that there is a planet going through this gap. And then you are not detecting the exoplanet in the optical like we are doing now with 800 or 1,000 exoplanets that have been found, but we are detecting the planet while it's being formed. So it's the old Earth. We will be able to detect old Earths in other stars. And in massive star formation, again, we will be able to... Now it was impossible to search for disks in high-mass stars, for example. It was a pity because it's one of the reasons that make people... So think that the formation of low-mass stars and high-mass stars is different, because in low-mass stars you were detecting disks, in high-mass stars it was not possible to detect disks, so they were saying, okay, maybe if there are no disks in massive stars, the formation process is different, or let's see what happens. But it was not possible to check this, and now with ALMA we will be able to go to stars located at 10 kiloparsecs or more, forming O-type stars, and then achieve a resolution that permits to say, okay, this dust emission that I'm seeing is flattened and is perpendicular to an outflow. It has some kinematic motions characteristics of a disk, so there is a disk there, and then probably there are also planets, who knows?
Wow. So there's going to be lots of answers coming up, but I suspect the results will also put the minds of theorists to a great deal of work to adapt the models.
Yeah, sure. They have to do the hard work now. Right now, there are several theoretical models that say that should be disks around massive stars. So if it's confirmed, these models are the right ones, probably.
Great. Well, that is exciting. Thank you very much for the talk and the interview.
Yeah, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah.